Hey everyone, a quick piece of context for this episode. We're playing a number of clips that include use of the N-word. When they originally aired on The Oprah Winfrey Show in 1987, they ran unedited. For our episode, we've bleeped them out.
Leah, I got a question for you.
What's up?
What comes to mind when I say Forsyth, Georgia?
Terror? Death? Racism? Place that I never want to go or vacation, right? Like, no disrespect to Georgia, but you know, I'm good on Forsyth. I'm not into it. No.
You would not be alone.
No. You know, and there's a reason for that. So for our listeners, a little bit of background on Forsyth, Georgia. It's a county and a town, and it's about an hour north of Atlanta. But it's the history that matters. In 1912, white residents drove out the entire black population. I'm not exaggerating here. They drove out every black man, woman, and child. There's this black part of town called Oscarville. And one night there's basically a knock on every door, right? Knock, knock, knock. And people, the black people inside are told, get out now. And these black people are run out of town by white residents.
Yeah. And we'll get into the context of why they were run out of town. But that town effectively becomes white and stays white for the next 75 years. Not a single black resident lived in Forsyth, Georgia, even into the 1980s and 1990s. So there are protests. People try to talk about, you know, what happened there and the abuse and the violence. It gets pretty rough. Slurs get thrown around. And, you know, as historians, we study this stuff. We know this violence. We know that Forsyth is not really an anomaly, which is unfortunate in and of itself. But I don't know. I think on this episode, you may not want to go there, Leah, but we got to go there. We got to go there because that's exactly what Oprah did with her show. Hello, and welcome to You Get a Podcast from Radiotopia. This is the unauthorized study of the Queen of Talk. We're breaking down some of the most iconic moments in the long run of the Oprah Winfrey Show. I'm your host, Kelly Carter Jackson.
And I'm Leah Wright Rigger.
And this episode, we've been planning for a while. It's likely one of the most controversial episodes that Oprah has ever aired. She really says so herself. In 1987, what does Oprah do? She takes her crew on a trip and they decide to broadcast their show in Forsyth, Georgia, and talk about the town's racial history.
Now, keep in mind, 1987, that's pretty early in the history of Oprah Winfrey and the Oprah Winfrey Show. So this is Oprah 1.0, before she's really found her voice, and she's really still experimenting with how salacious or in the mud she wants her show to be. And I think that's really important context for what we're going to talk about today. But at this moment, she has decided, the show has decided, they want to dive right into the controversy. They want to talk about this town's racist past and racist present.
What's the difference between a black person and a n***er to you?
I've talked to black people. Black people, they don't want to come up here. They don't want to cause any trouble. That's a black person. A n***er wants to come up here and cause trouble all the time. That's the difference.
And this episode, ratings banger, right? The episode is a sensation from the moment it aired in 1987, for sure. And we should also say that it sort of got like a little bit of a revival, new attention, not that long ago, when Tamron Hall, she was hosting a series as part of the Oprah Winfrey Show's 25th anniversary. And they did an episode looking back on this moment. They played some of the wildest clips and people were like, oh my God. It's bad, y'all. It's really bad. I think a lot of us have forgotten what happened in the late 80s and what Oprah was doing with her show. And today, we're going to dive in.
I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison. But it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1987, the Oprah Show had only been on the air for 5 months. Trouble was brewing in the Deep South, in a county where no black person had lived in 75 years. For the first time, Oprah left her studio and headed straight into the eye of the storm.
Leah, I want to get your thoughts. This is 5 months after her show has started. So she's a newbie, right? She still comes on really in journalist mode. I mean, the show opens up with her sort of standing outside. The wind is blowing. Her hair is sort of blowing all over the place. She's got the giant shoulder pads that are classic 80s.
We bring you today to Forsyth County, Georgia, just 30 miles north of Atlanta, which in the past few weeks has gained the reputation of being a hotbed of racism.
And she is, you know, setting up the tone of what this conversation is going to be like, which is in her studio, nothing but Forsyth residents. She only had people that lived in Forsyth in the audience of her show. That's why the show was all white. And they make that clear in the show as well. But previous to that, there had been a march in Forsyth, Georgia, led by Hosea Williams, a civil rights activist who's one of Dr. Martin Luther King's right-hand man, who helped organize a lot of the marches that took place during the long freedom struggle. And he's marching in Forsyth to basically say, like, listen, this all-white town, we need integration. Better yet, we need reparation because this all-white town used to be a black town. We'll come back to that.
Here are just some of the images of Forsyth County in past weeks that were broadcast around the globe.
There's no here. Why should they even come, you know? They asked for it. They got it.
Leah, do you remember this episode? Do you remember how explosive this was?
I do. It's shocking. I think, you know, we're historians, Kelly, but of course we have to see the connections between past and present. Yeah. It absolutely evokes memories of the Unite the Right rally from a few years ago.
Yeah, Charlottesville.
So it's hugely controversial. It's also the show that, you know, the folks that we've had on our series have mentioned the most. It's also the episode that the audience and people and listeners have mentioned as being the most impressionable episode for them as well.
Yeah. So we brought on the perfect guest for this episode, none other than Dr. Carol Anderson. She is the Charles Howard Chandler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of White Rage. Is this not perfect? White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. She's won numerous awards. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She is a Washington Post Notable Book Award winner. Her latest book is The Second, about race and guns in America. Again, we could think of no one better to have this conversation.
No one better.
With us. And you live in Georgia. Right there in Atlanta. Like, this is going to be a lot.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So can you tell us, how did you come to this episode? Did you watch it live, or did you go back and just watch the rerun to freshen up?
I did not see it live. But I watched the rerun to freshen up. YouTube is an amazing, amazing beast. and also, I believe I read about it in Patrick Phillips' Blood at the Root, that deals with Forsyth County, that takes you to the mass lynching and the ethnic cleansing that happened in 1912, and then brings you all the way through to that march in 1987. That then becomes the focus for Oprah's episode.
What did you think of this episode when you saw it?
You know, when I saw the full episode, let me back up. First, I saw the excerpt from Tamron Hall, where you don't get any of the leavening. You just get the full-blown...
As protests were going on outside, tempers were heating up inside, too.
Somebody... Tell me, Where did the people who come from who were shouting, go home? They came from where?
Yes, ma'am. They came from, my name's Frank Shirley. I'm the head of the committee to keep Forsyth and Dawson County white.
I mean, you get the venom. Mm-hmm. You get the hatred. Mm-hmm. You get the pure uncut USDA kilo of pure uncut white.
Let him speak. Please let him speak. He has the right to speak.
Okay, the news media is covered up. There were thousands of white people that came out to join our white people's protest. This is the largest white people's protest against communism and race mixing in the last 30 years.
So you just got the N-word, the N-word, the N-word, the N-word. Those people, those people, those people. I only want law abiding. It was so reduced that it just felt like being hit with a fire hose out of Birmingham. Mm. That's what it felt like. Like it was ripping the flesh right off of you. It was horrific.
You don't believe that people of other races have the right to live here?
They have the right to live wherever they want to, but we have the right to choose if we want a white community also.
That's what you saw happening there. And it reminded me so much of the White Housewives yelling at Elizabeth Eckford in Little Rock, you know, just spewing the N-word at her. Yeah. Just, I mean, where she was absolutely dehumanized. She was not a child of God. She was that thing that was out to destroy everything that they held dear. And that's what you saw emanating out of that episode, out of the excerpt. And so when I saw that excerpt, and, you know, and it was only like 4 minutes, I was just like, Lord, I don't think I could watch the full episode.
Oh, right? Right? Yes.
That's a lot.
I felt my blood pressure going up. I felt the kind of tenseness that happens when you are surrounded by that kind of venom. I thought of Fred Leonard, who was the freedom rider when he was in Birmingham, and he talks about getting off of the bus in Birmingham. And he said there was all these angry white people, and we just took off running. And because lead pipes were flying, bricks were flying, they were getting beaten. And that's what, I thought about Oprah standing in the middle of that.
Yeah.
Going, ooh, how she had to maintain her Oprah-ness. You know,
her composure.
I'm here to understand your feelings. So why did you say that? What's the difference between a black person and the N-word?
Yeah.
What's the difference between a black person and an N-word to you?
I've talked to black people. Black people, they don't want to come up here. They don't want to cause any trouble. That's a black person. A who wants to come up here and cause trouble all the time. That's the difference.
How she had to like look these people in the face who clearly hate her. And she is surrounded, you know, and every now and then somebody white would stand up and say, you know, I'm not like that. This is a God-fearing county. We believe in the Bible. We believe that all are equal, you know, and so you would get a few of those, but you still got our white rights are being violated. How dare they come in here? I mean, so it was palpable in that space. And I just went, I don't know how Oprah does this.
I know.
I do not know how Oprah does this.
I have to say, my immediate reaction was similar to what Carol just mentioned, which is, as I was queuing up the clips and going back and I started watching, I was like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can do this. And, you know, they're chanting, they're like, you know, whites have rights. It feels like cartoon level villainy. And then you see, you know, Hosiah Williams and these other black protesters marching. They seem like very everyday, ordinary people. And, you know, I'm sure we'll come back to this because this becomes a whole thing for the audience about how, oh, it's outside agitators. These are these are actors. Mm-hmm. Our blacks are happy here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But they're like ordinary everyday people. They're farmers, they're laborers, they work in grocery stores, they work in banks. They are just everyday people. Here they are marching for basic rights, the right to be considered human. And I'm like, you know, I don't know if I want to spend my day thinking about this today. particularly when it's hitting home little too much.
Something that was almost 40 years ago feels like it was done 4 days ago.
Yes. Right.
I mean, the through line. Yeah. The through line
the
for
through
me.
The through line.
You want to know what the kicker was for me is that while I'm watching this, and I feel like audience members, I watched so you don't have to. Like, I watched this and comment after comment, Oprah's like in her mode, you know, she's going all over the audience. The audience is packed where it's basically almost standing room only in this theater-esque that they've created to have this town forum. And she's going all over the place and putting the mic in other people's face and saying, okay, what do you have to think? And what are you saying? What do you think? And every person that, quote unquote, could be considered a white liberal was like, oh, you know, we treat black people nice. I have black friends. I have black coworkers. You know, I wouldn't mind having a black neighbor as long as they were law abiding. That's always the caveat, law abiding. And what I realized is that even among the white liberals, racism is not structural. Racism is not systemic. Racism is just good manners. It's just basic decency. Which I'm like, no, this is not what we're, you know, it's like it's this very simplistic idea of, you know, we don't talk about those things or we don't say those things, and that's what makes me a good person. Not like the real harm and violence that racism has caused to not just Georgia, but all across America, the theft of black labor, the theft of black wages, the theft of black lives. None of that's being discussed. It's all just, you know, that's not nice. Right. You know what? You can be kind. Your mom taught you manners. Like, what?
And so you begin to see part of the problem. And also what struck me in this was how many said, oh, the media is just distorting this. The media is just portraying all of Forsyth County as racist. But you noticed, as they kept talking about, we wouldn't mind if they were law-abiding. Is that how the media, the media portrayal of black folk doesn't come into that equation about the inequities there? So it's just, when the one guy's like, yeah, they moved into my neighborhood and they destroyed my neighborhood.
I'm afraid of them coming to Forsyth County. I lived in Atlanta. I was born in Atlanta. And in 1963, the first blacks were bused to West Fulton High School. And I go down there now and I see my neighborhood and my community, which was a nice community, a nice neighborhood. And now it's nothing but a rat-infested slum area because they don't care. They don't care. Thank you.
No, what? Shut up. You know. Do you mean they, us, the entire black race? The entire black race?
Blacks, and you have...
Again, we don't get any of the structural analysis about the resource base that was extracted from that neighborhood, about the refusal of city government, municipal governments, and county governments to invest in that neighborhood, the redlining that happened in that neighborhood. I mean, so none of those kinds of structural pieces are really, it's just that black folks moved in and the neighborhood went down. It's the same thing when they talked about, well, what are you afraid of? I want good schools for my kids. And those schools in Atlanta, they lower the standards so that black kids can succeed. Wow. I mean, so the language that we get now about affirmative action, about how it is about allowing those unqualified minorities to get our jobs, our college slots, that you see that brewing in that Oprah episode.
I mean, there's so much, I think, to tease out in this episode.
So much.
Not just the education, not just the housing, but I want to go back to this moment about like sort of the context for it, because I was saying before we got on that I've actually been to Forsyth, Georgia, and Carol's like, why? I can't even remember. This was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. We had some family event because I have a lot of family in Georgia. And so my dad was like, oh, why don't we go to Lake Lanier? I heard there's a really nice lake and we can like get lunch and all of that stuff. And so we all got together. It was maybe like 17 of us. We had lunch there. We had a good time. And then after we were leaving, my sister was like, yo, Dad, I think that lake is haunted. I started looking it up. I started doing a Google search. There used to be an all-black town here called Oscarville. I was like, what?
Absolutely is.
And she was like, yeah, there was, and this is also mentioned in the show, a lynching of three black men who were accused of raping a white woman. And they ran off about 1,100 of the black people that were living there. I knew as we were leaving town, there was a road that was like Jim Crow Road or something like that. I was like, y'all, we have got to get out of here. Like, the sun is going down. I mean, like, that kind of terror of just like, this is a place in which intense violence has happened. And there's no discussion of that violence. And I don't know if you caught this, but the guy who's being interviewed says, yeah, my grandfather witnessed those lynchings. He was 16 years old and watched those three black men get lynched. And he warned me ever since to be on the lookout for black people. And I'm like, what?
Not to be on the lookout for those who would do extra legal violence and murder somebody in full view, out in the open. Not to be on the lookout for that, but to be out on the lookout for black people. I mean, so these are the inversions that consistently happen in the narratives of American society.
I think I would add to this conversation is the fact that black people are missing from this narrative, that she doesn't interview Jose Williams. She doesn't interview black people and say, well, what would you want? Well, what have you lost? Well, what are you up against? Like, this is just, all of that is erased. And she says it in the show, oh, well, you didn't live in the town and we were only interviewing people in the town. And it's like, well, if you're going to have a balanced conversation, wouldn't it require that you speak to black people and find out even if they actually really want to live in this town? You know, there might be black people like, kick rocks, I don't want to live here. Like, you know, or I just want reparations for Oscarville, or I want, you know, I want my 40 acres, whatever it is. Like, that I thought was a missed opportunity, because we
see later on that it works with the Los Angeles riots episode. When she brings in black audiences. Now, I think that's done for a particular reason, right? Particularly given the space and the kind of violence, outward violence that is happening in Los Angeles. But in those instances, African Americans, in addition to being on the receiving end of violence, including historical long-term violence, are also perpetrators of violent acts, right? So there's an impetus, in addition to sweep suites, to actually interview them, right? That whole thing about, like, why loot? You know, why participate in looting and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
I think
she interviews the guy who looted, and he's like, yeah, I looted.
Yeah, I looted. I'd do it again. Versus in Forsyth, I think, you know, black people are objects. They are, you know,
only referred to as they or blacks throughout the episode.
The blacks.
Or N-words.
The blacks. Or the
or
N-word.
Or the N-word.
They keep saying they this and they that and they. And it's like, who are you talking about?
Right. This is also, to me, part of the talk show's weakness is that it can't do structure. It can do individual narratives, but it has trouble really unpacking the structure of this inequality. So, like, there are bad realtors, there are bad people, there are violent people, but it doesn't help you get the frame. And that's where the scholars come in to look at this and to provide the framing to make this make sense.
Hey everyone, Jody Avirgan here. I'm one of the producers of the show, and we've been away for a while, but we are so excited to be coming back with brand new episodes, a new season of the show under a new name, You Get a Podcast. Make sure you go to yougetapodcast.com to find out all the latest information. And on our website, we're running a one-time fundraiser over the next couple months during our new season. We're asking for your financial help, however you can, to help get the show back on its feet under its new name. You can give $5, you can give $50, I won't stop you, you can give as much as you want. But if you give $86 or more, we've got a special treat for you. Now, why 86? Well, 1986 is the year that Oprah started her show. So for everyone who gives $86 or more, we're going to do a special event with Kelly and Leah and the producers of the show. But look, whatever you can chip in, we really, really appreciate your support. This is a completely self-produced show. Your support will go directly to making new episodes. We've made it super easy for you. It's tax deductible. It takes 2 seconds. You can do it right on our website, yougetapodcast.com. Once again, yougetapodcast.com, and thank you. All right, here's Kelly and Leah.
So one thing I'll mention here too, as we talk about the show, is that even as there's this very conspicuous skirting of the question of violence directed at Black people, you can see the impact on Oprah Winfrey as she is sitting in this audience and growing increasingly uncomfortable, even as she has to maintain her journalistic professionalism. And so I think it's actually important that she does a show, you know, right after she launches the Oprah Winfrey Show. So we're still getting Oprah Winfrey, the hard-hitting journalist. And now I'm going to sit here, and she keeps saying this over and over throughout the show as she is wearing her professional garb. She's got her professional hair, right? Like, even as these people are saying things that are just wildly inappropriate, let him speak. And so I think it's worth thinking about that, because by the end of the show, she looks exhausted. She later says that she did not feel safe, that she was going to be attacked.
You know, was actually pretty scared when we did that. I remember clearly thinking, I want to get out before the sun goes down, because I don't think it would be safe to be here.
And I think that matters both in how we are looking at the show, how we remember the show, but then also in terms of how Oprah changes her show over the course of these, you know, 25 years that she's on the air.
You know, we were basically traumatized watching the clips. Mm-hmm. I think about the trauma that she had to feel being in that space. And so even when the liberals, so remember the towards the end, there was a young white woman who stood up and she's like, you know, we have to understand that there are white N-words and Black N-words, right? And she said, and I'm so glad that basically she called Oprah the N-word. And then she went, oops, no, I didn't mean that. So, you know, you're sitting there and you're Oprah going, even those who say, hey, I love Black people, or I'm not mad at Black people, or I don't hate Black people, I'm still the N-word. I mean, and that is so embedded in what made Forsyth County, Forsyth County.
So here's the thing about the young white woman, and I come back to this because we did another episode on the LA riots, and there was also another young woman who made comments about, you know, like not having all of the evidence for the Rodney King beating, or sort of giving the police the benefit of the doubt. And we had joked with Elizabeth Hinton that, like, you know, there is this through line. Like, are these people at the Capitol? Do you know what I mean? Like, this was 40 years ago, but how do we think of sort of the ways in which this infiltrates and reincarnates itself into other people, into other ideas that keep perpetuating over and over and over again. So but that whether we're talking about Forsyth, Georgia, or we're talking about the LA riots, or we're talking about January 6th, there is such a constant through line of racism and hatred, and these mythical ideas about what is being taken away from white people, or how whiteness is being diluted, that, you know, this train runs right on time. Right. Like, it is so constant.
Well, you know, it's when the one guy toward the end of the show says, do you want your daughter to be married to Juan? Do you want your children to be mixed, or something like that? And yeah. And that was the language that I heard reading through coming out of Reconstruction. That was also the language I heard in the 1906 race massacre here in Atlanta. You know, this thing about mongrelization, this thing about not about mixing.
Yeah, miscegenation.
Yeah, miscegenation. Mm-hmm. And you see that is a through line coming through. There's another through line coming through here, and that is the assumption of Black criminality.
Yes.
I mean, that is so foundational in the ways that they are like, we want to keep our neighborhood, our county, where it's safe. We want to keep our community, our community. You know, so we don't want to be like Atlanta. We don't want to be like Chicago, right?
Yeah. And law abiding. Law abiding gets thrown around like three or four times. You hear law abiding.
Exactly. I don't mind who moves next to me as long as they're law abiding. So you don't mind. So you don't want Donald Trump living next to you. Is that what you're saying? You know, so it's how law abiding becomes racialized. Mm-hmm. Also what we saw, you know, we're talking about through lies now. That's also what we saw with January 6th. Because there was a language when Newt Gingrich from Georgia says they stole the election in Atlanta. They stole the election in Philadelphia. They stole the election in Milwaukee. These are cities that have sizable Black populations. And that language of theft, that language of voter fraud, that language of stealing the election, stealing American democracy from good, honest, hardworking white folk. That is what was the trigger that sent folks up into that Capitol. The thing that American democracy was being stolen by Black people.
Yeah.
So this is what we when I saw that Forsyth interview from Oprah. One, I give her all the props because she was able to maintain throughout, and I don't know how. But the second piece was I was looking going, this is the fulmination. This is what comes out of the conservative wing, figuring out how do we strip the civil rights movement of its power? How do we turn it into something that we can deploy?
So I want to throw a wrench in the monkey. I want to, you know, what's the phrase? I want to complicate things. Uh-huh. That's what I'm trying to say. I want to complicate things. Oprah, I think there are aspects of her in the show that are perhaps a little too comfortable with the delineation between Black people and the N-word. And that to me, I mean, and, you know, Oprah said this before, I voted Republican and I voted Democrat, you know, like, but in this moment in the 80s, she's still very much in that conservative respectability politics era in which she does not necessarily defend Black identity in the way that you might expect her to or you would hope that she would. There's a part of that waffling between questions that feels like, well, hold up, Oprah, like, but where do you stand on this? Do you think that Black people come in and poor people come in and they destroy things, or that, you know, that we just need to pull our pants and we just need to go to school? And, you know, like these ideas of just like aspirational attainment that Black people will get there and I made it and everyone else is coming too. Like that is a little troubling to me as well. We see it later in her trajectory, but in that moment, I don't know. It's frustrating.
Well, one of the things that I picked up on was the guy from the National Association for the Advancement of White People.
Yes. yes.
Where he, you know, he's like, these are communists and these are gays.
In the last 30 years, the news media has deliberately covered up the nature of the Brotherhood marchers, many of whom are outright communists and homosexuals, and our organization was the only one that dared take a stand against them. They marched, they brought in thousands.
You're not just anti-Black, you're also anti-gay, too.
I'm opposed to communism, race mixing, and low morals, and homosexuals are of low morals, in my opinion.
And she did not push back. So what's wrong with someone who is gay? What is wrong with someone who is communist? And as we know, it is a long trajectory of linking the fight for equality with being a communist. So remember the Lavender Scare as part of the Red Scare during the McCarthy era, seeing that as being something that was degenerate, something that could get you blackmailed. And so we had to get you out of the government because you were vulnerable, because you were gay. I mean, so it is that kind of language. It's like it's the same kind of language of Black criminality, where that very being is something that is automatically suspect. And so whereas that audience is trying to create a differential between whites in that community. Yeah, there's some white folks who don't like Black people, but that's not all of us. And not seeing how that structure of inequality is doing the damage. And how having that buy-in to the structure of inequality is doing the damage. One of the things I think about is how what white supremacy needs is to have white folks buy into it. When white folks don't buy into white supremacy, the system begins to crack. I mean, so this is part of what you saw in the civil rights movement. I mean, so Hosea Williams was at the front with John Lewis on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 65 when, you know, you get Bloody Sunday. But when you think about it, there were white folks there, too. And particularly after Bloody Sunday, white folks poured into Selma. It was white folks refusing to be part of a system of white supremacists. So part of when she kept saying, what do you fear? What do you fear? Part of what the fear was that structure would crack and the inherent supremacy that's in that structure would no longer be theirs.
It all goes back to James Baldwin. I use that quote all the time about how he's like, you have to be committed. And the fear of commitment is the loss of your identity. And he's talking about white Americans and how that if you get really committed to this work, you have to relinquish those ideas of superiority. You have to relinquish those ideas that you are better or that you have something to gain by upholding this system. I know we need to wrap, so I want to ask a question that I think is necessary, which is, should this conversation have ever taken place? Should she have ever gone to Forsyth, Georgia and had this discussion, or should she have just left it completely alone?
It's interesting because this is the basis of Oprah doing another show on like skinheads that goes completely wrong. And Oprah says this is the moment that she realizes that she has this huge platform and she should not be giving racists a platform, right? Like the power of the platform. It's these two moments. And she's like, I'm not going to redo that. You know, in our background investigation for talking about this episode, we came across several, you know, references to Oprah Winfrey saying she wanted to return to Forsyth or at least bring back a couple of the guests from the show, like to see come full circle because it's one of her most popular shows. It's a rating killer, but it never actually happens. And so I think, and she has talked about before, like this is one of the shows that she regrets, like that she gave these people a platform. As a historian, I'm going to say it is invaluable for thinking about the average, everyday, ordinary attitudes of white Americans and how particularly, right, like let's take the NAAW, that, you know, that acronym is not good. National Association for the Advancement of White People. That is not a good, like, do better, my guy. But it, like, if we take him to the park, because he was clowning, right? There is a way in which there are a lot of people in the audience who, as they are espousing very racist things that we can see as racist today, to other white people in the audience, it sounds completely reasonable. And at different points, it sounds reasonable to Oprah. So there's, you know, there's a fantastic historian, Nathan Connolly, who always says that white supremacy is not upheld simply by white people, right? Like they are the architects of it. But there also have to be Black people who contribute to it for whatever reason, right? There are a myriad of reasons why they contribute to it. And oftentimes it is not intentional. And I think this is one of those moments, like when people are saying up and they're like, I just want to be able to pick who my neighbors are, right? And I want to like hang around good people, right? Good Black people. That, quote unquote, sounds reasonable, particularly within the context of the 1980s. And I think it is important for historians, social scientists, journalists to be able to access that snapshot and be like, this wasn't a joke. This was one of the most popular episodes of daytime television, period.
During Sweeps Week, I should say that. It dominated Sweeps.
Wow.
Dominated Sweeps. I mean, the ratings were off the charts. 63%, 69% were tuning in to this show. So if we want to ask, should she have done it? The producers are like, yes, 1,000 times over. But I don't know, Carol, what are your takeaways? What do you make of this?
Yeah, I'm with Leah that for historians, this is rich because we're able to see the vein of ideologies that then fed into Trumpism. We're able to see some of the culmination of the work that was being done in the 50s, 60s, and 70s to counter this move for Black equality, to counter this move for African-American citizenship. So when they're like, I should be able to say who lives next to me. Okay, that Shelley V. Kramer that dealt with restrictive covenants said, no son, no son, no son. But but I also think that what that did, it didn't move the needle forward. What moved the needle forward in Forsyth County was, in fact, economic development. It was the sprawl of Atlanta. It was the push of development that opened that county up. So Oprah talking did not move the needle. It just, one, gave a platform, and he was working it. The National Association for the Advancement of White People. He was like, oh, and the Jews, and right? Yeah. I mean, he was there all.
Gave out their mailing address.
Right.
On TV, yes. Right?
Right? You know, this was a recruitment tool. And so I think about what this means. And I also think about, frankly, the trauma that Oprah had to feel being in that moment. So, I don't think that it moved the conversation forward at all. I think it was really important for historians to be able to see. I mean, this was like this incredible bouillabaisse, this petri dish that we were able to look at and see it just boiling, toiling, all of that.
You know, it's so funny to me, though, because I think we've become too focused on this being a Southern phenomenon. I think people can see Forsyth, Georgia, and they can throw it away because that's so South. That's so racist. Right. But the truth is, she could have filmed this show in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Okay. She could have filmed this show in Deerfield, Illinois. She could have filmed this show in any white enclave in the North, anywhere in the country. Right. And gotten a very similar outcome.
Okay, so you remember...
if not more violent.
Yeah, so you remember when King moved the movement north and went up to Chicago?
Went to Chicago!
Woo! Mm-hmm. And he got bricked, stoned in Cicero, Illinois. And he said it was worse than anything that he had experienced in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. This is an American phenomenon.
Yes.
And that's where you got this kind of backlash going, oh, no, we're not like that. We're not like that.
And that's what's so, I feel like, problematic about the episode is that people will look at it and they'll dismiss it. They'll throw it away. Someone in Chicago or New York will say, we're not Alabama, and keep it moving. And I'm like, you don't understand. We're all Alabama. Alabama is leading the nation right now.
That's what Fannie Lou Hamer says, right? Yes, like Harlem is Mississippi and on.
Yes. It's just, it's a lot. We want to say, as we close, thank you so much, Carol Anderson. This was, I don't know if I can call it fun because it's a little traumatic. What is that? This was good. Interesting.
It was good.
This was rich.
Yeah, it was rich. Thank you. And you know, all of our work, we're always looking into the abyss. We're always looking at the horrific things that have happened in this nation. And this is another one of them. And so being able to be with you, my sister, it's just been wonderful. Thank you.
Come back.
I know. Come back.
Anytime.
We want to once again thank our very special, very wonderful guest, Carol Anderson of Emory University. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Her many books include The Second, One Person, One Vote, and of course, White Rage. You can find out lots more about her work by checking out her website, ProfessorCarolAnderson.org. She is fantastic, and we were so lucky to have her.
You Get a Podcast is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Special thanks to Audrey and Yuri and everyone at Radiotopia. Remember, sign up for our newsletter, send us an email, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You can find out more and help support the show on our website at yougetapodcast.com. You Get a Podcast is a production of Roulette Productions. Our executive producer is Jody Avergan. Our producer is Nina Ernest. Our beautiful artwork is by Jonathan Conda.
I'm Kelly Carter Jackson.
And I'm Leah Wright-Rigger.
Class dismissed. See you next time.
Radiotopia.